It's Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today, we are going to be talking about sin and football and car accidents and priests and George Takei. Oh, my. Dealing with the new movies Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, If I Stay, When the Game Stands Tall, Calvary, and To Be Takei. And we're also going to be talking about some news and some box office predictions, the trailer park, and of course the world-famous DVD roundup. But before we get into all that, this is how you get in touch with me. If you want to email me, you can email fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or on facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. If you want to reach me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Let's talk about a couple news stories. There's really only two I want to address, and I know I'm ignoring an awful lot of movie and entertainment news. And the first one's not even a movie issue. It's a television issue. It was announced this week. I mean, seriously, just a week before the premiere of Doctor Who, the new season, Series 8, with Peter Capaldi as the new Doctor, it was announced that Jenna Louise Coleman, who plays the lovely and adorable Clara Oswald, his relatively new companion, because she started with Matt Smith in the last season, Coleman is going to be leaving the show at Christmas, which is sad, because, I mean, I had a real thing for Jenna Coleman. I thought she was just adorable, and she's beautiful. I do think that it makes sense, because they kind of already played their card with her character. If you follow Doctor Who, and you'll know the story of the Impossible Girl, which was all tied in with the 50th anniversary of the series. They kind of already played all their cards. I mean, she had the most, a lot of the companions, especially in this new run of the series, a lot of the companions have a direct, very important impact on the Doctor's life. But, I mean, she was probably even more important, possibly even more significant than Amy Pond, if you look at the grand scheme of the Doctor's life. So, anything after that is kind of damsel in distress territory, I think, which is usually when these companions leave. Now, I, of course, go back to the old days when Elizabeth Sladen was Sarah Jane Smith with the fourth Doctor, and Louise Jameson was Leela, kind of one of my personal favorites with the fourth Doctor. So these companions just kind of, because it wasn't as big of a show, it wasn't as culturally aware, at least internationally, as it is now. Now it's much more of a TV series where they're cycling people through. So I'll be curious to see who they get. Here's my prediction, though. I think they're talking about using a guy from one of the shows that Peter Capaldi's also on in Britain. They're also talking about people from Game of Thrones. In fact, another redhead, which will be his third ginger companion, which I think is kind of interesting, considering how much they make fun of themselves in this series. Here's my prediction on what's going to happen with Doctor Who and his companions. They're going to get another young, attractive woman. I think he's going to have two, though, this time. So we're going back to the Harry Sullivan, Sarah Jane Smith days, or way back to the second Doctor when he had multiple companions. I think they're going to get a young, attractive woman and a young, hot man, a really hot, fit man to do it, a guy in his 20s. Because David Tennant and Matt Smith had a definite sex appeal for the ladies, and over the last 5-6 years, Doctor Who has become huge for the female audience. So, when you're putting a guy who's in his 50s and you're casting him as the Doctor, which is the first time we've had an old Doctor taking over the role since Jon Pertwee did in the early 70s, I mean, unless you count Tom Baker, I think was 40 when he started, that was about how old Sylvester McCoy was. This is the first time you've got an old Doctor taking over the role for the series. They're losing that sex appeal, because you don't have the 20-year-old British girls screaming for Peter Capaldi to take off his clothes that he did for Matt Smith and David Tennant. So they're going to have to transfer that to the companions. Mark my words, that's what's going to happen. Anyways, Doctor Who Season 8 premieres this weekend. I'm extremely excited. I'm a big Whovian. So that's that news. The next piece of news I want to talk about, it was a story on comicbook.com talking about the fact that there are people working on the original Star Wars trilogy on Blu-ray, unaltered, not the special editions, the unaltered Star Wars original series. And that was quickly debunked by like Badass Digest and a bunch of other websites. And here's why I tend to actually believe comicbook.com. A lot of people are saying the big reason that that's never going to happen is because Lucas has said he doesn't want that to happen. And 20th Century Fox has the distribution rights through 2020 for the original trilogy. And they actually own Star Wars itself, the movie. That is not a Lucasfilm property, in fact. And then you've got Disney and you got 20th Century Fox to work it out with and George Lucas in the fray. I don't think that that's a problem. First of all, I don't think George Lucas is a problem because George Lucas washed his hands of everything Star Wars when he sold it to Disney. And that's evidenced by people. There was an interview where somebody ambushed him and asked him about, I think it was about Harrison Ford breaking his foot. And George Lucas was like, it's not my thing now. I don't own it. He doesn't have the rights to it. And while he might have contractually said that he could veto this, I don't think he cares at this point. He washed his hands and he moved on. And Disney wants to release it because Disney is totally into releasing anniversary editions, 45th anniversary editions, 30th anniversary editions. People forget that in 3 years, it's going to be the, 40th anniversary of Star Wars? You don't think that Disney's going to want to release a 40th anniversary Blu-ray set of the original trilogy to coincide with another one of their movies coming out? And 20th Century Fox is very easy to get on board because it's just a brokering deal. You get studios to package their stuff all the time. In fact, Disney packaged all the Marvel movies, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and they had Universals. They had stuff from Universal, stuff from Paramount, not even just stuff that they bought from Marvel. They had a deal with Universal owning the Incredible Hulk. This is not a problem. These are not insurmountable obstacles. These are the kind of things that people deal with all the time in video distribution. I do not think, though, they're going to come out as a separate disc. I think they're going to have this massive 40th anniversary box set with slots for the next couple movies that you can buy in like 3 years. And they will include the original unaltered versions on Blu-ray for the first time, but you're going to have to buy that whole set. All right, with that sound, that means we're going to be rolling into the trailer park. We're going to move in really quick on this one. The first one I want to talk about comes out October 1st, and it is called A Good Marriage, and it's based on a Stephen King book about a woman who thinks she's married to a serial killer.
Through hard work and lots of love, my parents have created something very rare. A good marriage.
Marjorie Duvall moved here after her divorce 5 years ago. Miss Duvall's body was discovered early this morning.
Elements of the crime suggest that it was the work of the notorious serial killer who calls himself Beatty.
I gotta say, this is from, I think, Screen Media, which normally has a less than stellar reputation about putting together fantastic films. They would do some lower level independent stuff that maybe got a little bit of festival play, but they were sometimes not as well made as they could be. This trailer, though, looks pretty good. But I remember the days when a Stephen King movie was an event. I mean, back in the 80s, sure, you had stuff like Maximum Overdrive, which is terrible. But there was a big deal for a Stephen King movie to come out. This is sort of squeaking out there with nobody really noticing it under the radar, which is kind of sad. That shows where Stephen King's career is. But that's okay. It looks like it's a decent film with some good acting in it. Joan Allen is in it. I think she's going to do a fantastic job. And as Anthony Paglia is in it. And he's a good actor. I think that it's a good cast. And it's an intimate, small story, so I think it could do well. I'm curious to see it now. The next one I want to talk about is Night at the Museum, Secret of the Tomb. This is the third Night at the Museum movie. It comes out December 19th.
Now, you and I both know there's something magical in the museum. The sun goes down, tablet starts to glow, and everything comes to life.
There's something wrong with the tablet.
We shall all be dead by sunrise.
We have to go to London to figure this out.
Sir Lancelot,
at your service.
Theodore Roosevelt, President of the United States of America.
I have no idea what that means.
And yes, that was the late, great Robin Williams in the role of Teddy Roosevelt, one of his final films. I'm looking forward to this one. I have to say, I know there's a lot of people who malign these movies, but you know what? I found them fun. I liked the first two movies, you know, sue me. I thought they were entertaining. There's stuff I could take my kids to. I gotta say, I'm kind of looking forward to this one. It's at least going to be a little more appropriate for a Christmas release than stuff like Hot Tub Time Machine 2 and The Interview, which both look funny, but it's not exactly something I'm going to take my kids to. Anyways, I need to go to a break. When I come back, we're going to be talking about If I Stay and Calvary. are coming at you with Fat Guys at the Movies. We're going to be moving into the reviews. These are some smaller releases. I like to do the smaller releases first, you know, ease you into the big releases of this. Actually, I say that, but this first one I'm going to be talking about, I consider it a small release. It could likely win the weekend. And that is If I Stay. In a coma after a devastating car accident, a gifted high school cellist reflects on her life.
Isn't it amazing how life is one thing and then in an instant it becomes something else? Like here I am, Mia, the girl who thinks about the cello and Adam, and just like that.
Mom! Teddy! Dad! Am I dying?
Here's the secret, baby. If you live, if you die, it's all up to you. Whatever fight you got in you, you gotta pull it out now.
This is one of those movies that I respect, but didn't particularly like. It is a well-made movie. It's a well-acted movie. Chloe Grace Moretz, it's one of her transitional roles. And I gotta give the girl credit. Even though she was never like a baby, she wasn't like a three-year-old or, you know, she wasn't like Macaulay Culkin as a child actor, but she was a child actor. I mean, she was like 12 or whatever when she did Kick-Ass and a bunch of other movies leading in. And she's making that transition into adulthood pretty smoothly. And even though she's playing a high school kid, she's like 17 or 18 in this movie, she is doing a much more grown-up role, and she's not being as completely obnoxious and out there. She's not pulling a Miley Cyrus, so to speak, in the acting version of that. And she's not pulling a Lindsay Lohan and going completely off the skids on this one. But she does a fine job. She's a good actor. It's a well-acted movie. The cast is good. And the story's okay. It's a real button-pushy kind of movie. I mean, it finds the buttons and it pushes them. And it's like a kid in an elevator. It just keeps pushing the buttons. And it is a movie that sometimes lays things on a bit thick, but I can sort of forgive some of that because it's kind of told from her point of view. So and it's based on a book. So I'm assuming that it's using her perspective. And of course it's, you know, her infatuation and later love of this boy at school. It seems very corny and storybookish and, you know, overly simplified, but that's because it's got a 17-year-old girl in the lead role reacting to it. And that's a very realistic portrayal. Those parts just didn't get me because they felt like it was a well-made Nicholas Sparks movie. And I do not like Nicholas Sparks. And I think the movies that he's been doing have gotten cornier and cornier and schmaltzier. So it's not at that level. I mean, this is not, Safe Haven or The Lucky One or something like that. It's a little more quality. But it has a couple things that I just don't particularly respond to. One of them, and it's a lot about the music. She's a cellist. Her boyfriend's a rock star in Portland. He's kind of this guy who's got a band, and he's well known in Portland, not really much elsewhere. And so it's sort of the classic rock meets the classical. And so you've got a lot of music involved in it. And while I love music, I think music's a beautiful thing. I'm not somebody who, I could never write about music. I could never be a music journalist because I just don't have the intimate interest in it that I do in movies, for example. But if you are into films, it's sort of like Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, if you remember that film with Kat Dennings and Michael Cera. That was, gosh, 5-6 years ago. That is the kind of movie this is in terms of that's the crowd it's going for. It's also going for the and I have no other way of putting it, but the misery porn crowd. These are the people who watch The Killing. People who just like to see people going through anguish and pain and heartache and dealing with difficulty in their life and dealing with stress and painful, awful, horrible things happening to them, whatever life throws at them. I don't get into that. And I know there are people like my mother-in-law would probably just love this movie because that's the kind of stuff she likes to watch. She likes to watch stuff where, oh, I'm watching this movie about how, you know, a shark climbed out of the ocean and came into a house and ate, you know, 17 families in an apartment house. Isn't it tragic? And I'd be like, that's a shark. That's amazing. And she's just like, oh no, but look at the children that died. That's the kind of movie this is. This is so into the emotion and I'm not. And this is all me just justifying the fact that I'm giving it a kind of sucks review, but for the people who it would touch, I think they're going to like it. But I still think it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Calvary. And this is a film starring Brendan Gleeson as a priest in a small Irish town who receives a death threat during confession and grapples with how to handle the experience.
I'm here to listen to whatever you have to say.
I'm going to kill you, Father.
Certainly a startling opening line.
Things you hear in confession these days. The mess people make of their lives.
You're a very nice looking young woman.
This is my daughter Fiona.
But you're a priest.
I was married before I became a priest.
You can do that, can you?
It would appear so.
There's no point in killing a bad priest, but killing a good one. That'd be a shock.
This is written and directed by the guy who did The Guard, which also starred Brendan Gleeson a couple years ago, which was a great movie, but kind of forgotten. It wasn't even on the radar of most people in the U.S., and it got a little bit of award season buzz, but it never really got anything outside of that. The big reason to see this movie is for Brendan Gleeson's performance, because he's fantastic in it. And he manages to give a very realistic, truthful portrayal of clergy, an imperfect person who people look to be perfect, but also get upset when you judge them. But that's kind of his job. And you can see the characters being a caring a priest who can deal with people, but also who has baggage on him. And he's dealing with his own demons and his own problems and trying to do ultimately what's best for him and his parish, no matter how dangerous and painful it can be for him and the people around him. You know, I could get very art house-ish and go through this and say, well, there's all these other characters in them, and each one represents one of the seven deadly sins, or rather, a lot of them represent the deadly sins in different stages of sinning. One woman's an adulterer, and another woman is recovering from the sins of adultery, you could say. You know, one person is having urges to commit violence, and another one's obviously there's one person in there who is also grappling with wanting violence because given a death threat to the priest. There's a lot of dense theology buried in the movie that I really could have more time to expound on, but it's at on the surface, it's also just a very interesting character study of a guy trying to decide what to do and whether or not to let that happen and whether or not that's going to be a good thing and whether the outcome is part of what his calling is. And obviously, it's a very significant title for what's going on in the movie. And it also grapples certain social issues. The reason why the person wants to kill the priest, that's in there. But it doesn't harp on that, and it doesn't keep bearing down on that relentlessly. It's just, this has happened, and this is why that person threatened it. I think it's a very well-done movie that I think will, again, get completely forgotten in award season. I think Brendan Gleeson has a shot at getting a couple good acting consideration nods, but overall, I just don't think people are going to respond to it. Not in the U.S. It's an Irish movie, and it plays much more in sort of that Irish cadence. It's not a lickety-split action movie. It's not Calvary by Michael Bay. Or even Marvel. But I do think it's going to get lost, which is kind of sad because it's a pretty good movie. So I'm going to say Calvary kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And with that, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, and When the Game Stands Tall. Because we can! Oh, oh. Oh, oh. Welcome back to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm ready to talk about what Hollywood hopes is going to be the big movie, even though we talked about the one in the last segment that's probably going to be the big movie. And this movie is Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. Robert Rodriguez directs this adaptation of Frank Miller's gritty pulp noir comic books.
Sin City's where you go in with your eyes open. Or you don't come out at all.
You're the only man I ever loved.
Death is just like life in Sin City. It always wins.
You never thought we'd stand a chance against the most powerful man in the state. Maybe I'll go crazy. Crazy sounding pretty good right now.
I loved, absolutely loved the first Sin City. I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was groundbreaking. I thought it was a brilliant piece of directing by Robert Rodriguez and a very generous piece of directing as well, because one of the things he did with it is make it mirror the comics as much as possible, to the point of crediting Frank Miller as a co-director, because he's the guy who conceived the storyboards, which he used the book as the storyboards. Now, I'm assuming he did essentially the same thing in this movie. Now, there are times when the first one didn't quite translate as well as it could have, but it still looked and was fantastic. We've had 9 years since that happened, and that means 9 years of TV shows with virtual sets, TV shows like Sanctuary, TV shows like V, TV shows like Once Upon a Time. So virtual sets are nothing new, and it's also at a time after the Frank Miller other graphic novels, the 300 graphic novels, got adapted as well. And it's also after several years of Robert Rodriguez not actually producing a very good movie. The question is, did it work? And I have to say, for the most part, it did. I've not been a fan of Robert Rodriguez's more recent stuff. I think he's actually done some pretty awful things. I mean, the Machete movies, the first one was okay. The second one was really terrible. And if you look at his filmography, he has done, after Sin City, he did Planet Terror, which was pretty good. But then he did Shorts, which was kind of dumb. Machete, which was Spy Kids, which before, or All the Time in the World, which is terrible. And Machete Kills, which was also terrible. He has not been doing great films in the last decade. Sin City does redeem himself a bit, but then again, he's also just doing exactly what he did in the first one. Now, there's a part in the middle where it just kind of really kind of falls off the rails, gets a really goofy and silly, which is a fine line to tread. They avoided that mostly in the first movie. You get a little more goofiness and silliness in this movie, and that's a shame because it is such a dark and heavy film. But, I mean, it's essentially a Sin City movie. It's got the same kind of characters, it's got the same style of shooting, it's got the same level of violence, the cartoonish level of violence, but still very gritty and gory. I enjoyed it. I thought it was well done. The biggest problem was I had trouble sort of keeping track of what had happened and what hadn't happened, because there are characters that I believe died in the first film that are somehow back in this one, but this events in this movie take place after the events in the first film. I still am a little bit confused. But, of course, this is a series of graphic novels that Frank Miller did, so he's still adapting from existing source material. So it's a win for Robert Rodriguez, because it's a well-done movie. It's also a win for the actors involved. I think that Mickey Rourke does a fantastic job again as Marv. Joseph Gordon-Levitt doesn't annoy the heck out of me in the movie. Powers Booth plays a great villain. And there's two separate stories. Plus, you get Eva Green in the movie, and she's naked through probably about half the film, gratuitously showing her breasts. And as we've established before, I'm a huge fan of Eva Green's breasts. So this is a movie that's I'm assuming, very similar to the graphic novels. It's very similar to the first film. It feels like they rolled right into the next one. You can see a little bit of aging on a couple of the actors. Not many. I mean, actually, you know who ages the most in this is was Jessica Alba, because in 2005, I mean, she was really young then. And now she's a mother and a wife, and she's probably in her 30s by now. So she's, I mean, she's still gorgeous. She's still beautiful. I still would not say no to a lap dance from Jessica Alba. But you can tell that she's a little bit older than this movie. She's not that fresh-faced ingenue that she was in the first, especially when they flash back to her. So yeah, I enjoyed it. I'm going to say Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, rocks. Not as good as the first one, but still pretty doggone good.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is When the Game Stands Tall. A high school football coach uses his unique style to bring his team to an amazing 151-game winning streak, and then loses it.
12 years, 151 games in a row. But we were never just about winning. We were built on families.
Doing it, coach. Getting my baby out of Richmond.
And our town coming together.
The longest winning streak in sports history is now over.
But Losing the streak tested us all.
Let some punk pull you down at the 2-yard line.
Dad, please.
Don't let a game define who you are. Let the way you live your lives do that.
It's just a high school football game.
The biggest problem with this film is it's trying to do too much. It's trying to tell too many stories, and it's trying to be too many things. I mean, a film can be many things. A film can have many storylines, and it can have many characters. You can have a lot of subplots, but sometimes when a film has too much, it kind of gets in the way of the rest of it. It's hard to figure out what this film is. Is it a film about the coach, played by Jim Caviezel? Is it a film about the team? Is it a film about winning this 151 game winning streak and what happens when it's broken and how they recover? Or is it about the kids who are playing and what's going to be their destiny? Or is it about this coaching style and actually the how that supersedes winning, and even though it doesn't? That's what's the problem, because people think, oh, it's a movie about the streak because it's a true story, but it's not about the streak. And in fact, it's kind of at times saying, well, it's not about the streak, when it is kind of about the streak. I think it's having a trouble justifying its own existence, because kind of it's about the streak, and it's about the kids winning the streak and coming back to, you know, from a loss to actually start a new streak. And then they're like, no, it's not about the streak. So they're turning on a dime, flipping back and forth, which is a little bit schizophrenic at times. And is it supposed to be about the coaches, or is it supposed to be about the kids? Because they have several storylines with the kids. The coach is a real person, and it's based on a true story. The kids, I think, are kind of either fictional amalgamations or completely made up. So, I mean, there's something that happens in, it's in the trailer, but I'm not going to talk about it. It's not in the trailer I played, but it's in the trailer. And it's a significant thing that happens, like, in the second act. And I'm, like, waiting for this to be kind of the focus. And by the end of the movie, we kind of forget about it. The end of the movie, no one's really talking too much about it. And the movie doesn't know what it's trying to be. On one hand, it's like a faith-based film, because Jim Caviezel's, he's a pious Catholic, and he has been involved in multiple faith-based movies. And this one has a faith-based grounding, because De La Salle, the high school, is a Christian school, and they have the kids praying, and you have discussions of God. But it's not like God's not dead, or heaven is for real, or even Son of God, the very heavy-based, faith-based movies. It just kind of shows up a couple times. It's not even a character in the movie. So, again, it doesn't know if it's trying to be that or not. And I would say that it's kind of courting the faith-based audience because of the people involved and what they're trying to do, but it doesn't actually do a whole lot with that. On the same token, it's kind of courting the high school football fan audience. I mean, the kind of crowd that went to go see Friday Night Lights and Remember the Titans. But then it turns around and says, no, it's not about the game, but look at this really awesome game. It also commits a sin, and I said this to another critic as we were leaving. I said, it reminded me of Speed Racer. And she's like, what? And I said, well, because in Speed Racer, which is a neat movie, we get to this big race, and it's a fantastic race, and it's monumental and huge. And then we get to the end of the race, and I'm like, oh, that's the end of the movie. And I'm like, oh, no, they didn't get to the final race. There's still a whole half hour left. And that's what happens. There's this one game that's played like the climax. And then when it's over, you got 20, 30 minutes of movie left. And that's when it really kind of just drags on. So ultimately, I have to say that when the game stands tall, kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. All right, I need to go to a break. When I come back, it's going to be To Be To K, the box office returns, and the world-famous DVD roundup. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. We have more movies to talk about. Well, movie to talk about. We got one more film to talk about. You heard the music coming in. Star Trek. We're going to be talking about To Be Takei. The life of actor and social media phenom George Takei is profiled from his early acting days to his activism today.
Oh, my.
Hello out there. I'm Mr. Sulu of Star Trek.
As far as I can remember, I've always been me.
I have to tell you that in my email, no one gets more positives than George.
I totally love your smart humor on Facebook.
I was the best helmsman in the galaxy. And put to rest all that stereotype about Asian drivers.
Aye, aye, sir. Warp 3.
Oh, my. I have to say, I've always loved George Takei. I've loved him since he was Sulu in Star Trek. I remember watching reruns and, you know, as cool as Kirk and Spock were, I loved Sulu. I always thought he was really cool. Except he had that one piece of hair that was always out of place. I find George Takei fascinating because of the journey he's gone through with his public persona over the years. And, you know, when he came out a couple of years ago, it wasn't that long ago, though, that he came out. I mean, that's what I think was kind of amazing. And in the movie, he has an interview with Howard Stern where Howard Stern's like, look, everybody knew you were gay. Nobody, you're the only one who was telling people you weren't gay. Everybody else knew you were gay. He's such a fascinating person because of all the people in Star Trek, he's probably the most successful outside of the series. William Shatner he flirted with extra fame. I mean, he wrote books and stuff, but he was always and he did T.J. Hooker and a bunch of TV movies, but he wasn't any more famous after Star Trek, outside of Star Trek, than he was before. I mean, he did movies like, what is it, The Visitor or The Stranger, that Roger Corman film, and he did, of course, a bunch of Twilight Zones. And Leonard Nimoy, he did stuff outside of it. He directed movies. He directed Three Men and a Baby. Did you know that? Leonard Nimoy directed Three Men and a Baby. Then he was in movies like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and he was in a Western. I forget the name of it, but he was a bad guy in a Western. And he's done a whole bunch of stuff outside of his Spock persona. But it's George Takei who has blown up afterwards. And he really was marginally famous for Star Trek. He was a side character. The fact that he's become such a big deal in social media, I think, is adorable. And I think it's kind of amazing, his story, because this movie's not just about Star Trek, and it's not just about his Facebook page, and it's not just about him coming out and getting married to Brad, his longtime boyfriend and partner, who later now is his husband. It's also about his life and how he started off early in his life in a Japanese internment camp, because it was right during World War II, and they were rounding up the Japanese. And the fact that he had a positive outlook outside of that, and he came back and found a measure of fame and respect and so in a good place in the American culture, which really sort of marginalized him and his family when he was younger. And it tells about how he developed he actually created a musical. He helped write a musical based on his experiences in the camp. It's a fascinating film because it's so much more than his original persona, and it's so much more than his Facebook page. And I think it's great. I think it's an interesting profile. If you haven't seen it and you don't know much about George Takei, and all you know is that he sometimes posts some very funny things on social media, you should check this thing out, because it's a good movie. And it might be going down familiar road to somebody who knows about George Takei and knows his story and is a fan of Star Trek, but you know what, it's still worth checking out. So I'm going to give this movie a rocks. To be Takei, rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys in the Movies. Let's move on and talk about box office. Last week, I was kind of sort of right and kind of sort of wrong. I said that Let's Be Cops was going to win with $25 million. It did not, but it did make, over the course of its opening 5 days, if you take in Wednesday, I was pretty close. It made $26 million. It only made about $18 million over the weekend. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles took the weekend with just under $29 million, and then Guardians of the Galaxy at $25, which people are saying that it appears that Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is doing better than Guardians of the Galaxy. It's not. Guardians of the Galaxy had like a $90-some million weekend ahead of all this, so it's kind of keeping pace pretty well, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is doing well. So, you know, that franchise is back. Let's see how quickly it takes them to ruin that one. Let's Be Cops came in third with just under $18 million. And then The Expendables 3 came in with just under $16 million. So we'll get to that in a second. And then we had The Giver with $12 million, which kind of bombed. And this happens all the time. And people are freaking out, what's going on with the teen dystopian book movies? Well, this is the Harry Potter effect. When Harry Potter came out, they had a whole slew of movies like The Seeker of the Darkest Rising and Aragon and Inkheart. There were a whole bunch of teen stories that dealt with the sort of magic and a call to greatness. That all bombed after Harry Potter, and it wasn't until Twilight came that you got another teen book. So there are actually more teen books that bomb and go nowhere than actually become phenomena like Harry Potter and Twilight and Hunger Games. Not even Divergent. Divergent is sort of a hit. The Giver is just one of those movies that's not going to do well. Same thing's going to happen most likely with The Maze Runner in a couple weeks. because it's not something that I think an audience is going to go for. Plus, it also doesn't have a female protagonist, and those tend to have to. Before I go into my discussion about The Expendables 3, my box office prediction, I think that If I Stay is going to win this weekend. I think it's going to get the same kind of response that The Fault in Our Stars, only not as huge. So I'm thinking 18, 20-ish million. It had the most buzz going into the weekend. Let's talk real quickly about Expendables 3. A lot of people freaked out when they saw that number come up, and they're like, oh my gosh, only 16 million. Which, let's give a little bit of perspective here, because people forget. As The Expendables, as the series, the opening, this is almost half. It's like slightly more than half of what Expendables 2 made, and less than half of what the first Expendables made. And here's the thing. Release dates don't matter because these all essentially came out on the same weekend in three different years, 2 years apart each. This was a bomb. This fell hard. This is sort of like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Turtles in Time, Part 3, sinking of the battleship. This is not a good showing for the Expendables. And unless it does well overseas, the franchise is serious in trouble. Not just the franchise, but the Expendables, the female version of the Expendables, that might be on the chopping block too, because this thing did so poorly. Now, the big question is, what is the cause of this? Why did people stay away? Aside from just possible franchise fatigue. And as we know, last year we had The Last Stand, and you had A Bullet to the Head, and you had Escape Plan. You had all these movies with Schwarzenegger and Stallone that did not do well. So that's, and Parker with Jason Statham. So these sort of tough guy movies just aren't doing terribly well. So maybe that might be part of it. But a lot of people are saying, oh, piracy. This thing was downloaded 2.2 million times. Well, here's the thing. Just because 2.2 million computers downloaded it does not mean 2.2 million people watched it. There's a lot of people who just download stuff and don't watch it. There's a lot of people who just download stuff because they can. Now, I know some people did, and they may have shared it with their friends and given it to them on a disc and watched them in a group. But in general, I think you'd be lucky if 2 million people actually watched it. And out of those 2 million people, how many of those people would have gone and seen it had they had to pay? Maybe half, if you're lucky. And definitely, you know, would those people have gone and seen it at the opening weekend and contributed to that? No, you're looking at maybe a million people. You maybe lost a million people in the audience. So yes, that's significant because that's, you know, $6-8 million off the potential revenue. But even then, I'd be surprised if this thing would have made 20 million its opening weekend with or without the piracy. The thing that I think was damaging to it was the rating. And I'm not, and I said this last week, but there's a lot of people who said, well, why should I go see this movie? It's just a sanitized version. It's the Police Academy sequels where they went from R to PG, 13 to PG. They got more and more sanitized. The Revenge of the Nerds movies did it as well. The first one was raunchy and crazy, and it pushed the envelope and it did different things. And by the time they're doing like what Nerds in Paradise, they were going PG 13 and less. So ultimately, I think the PG-13 rating did, because just nobody wanted to see it, because they were doing it so the younger kids would see it, and younger kids weren't seeing it. Younger people were going to see Turtles and Guardians of the Galaxy, and so all it did was just cheese off the actual diehard fans of these 80s action movies, and they got an A-Team episode, and that's not what I think the audience necessarily wanted. And I've had people say, well, that's a dumb reason not to see the movie. Well, that's fine. You can think it's a dumb reason, but that's the reason I think a lot of people do. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to go into the DVD roundup. Real quick, we got to go through these. The first one I want to hit, of course, The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Not very good sequel, but it's out now on DVD and Blu-ray. Chef, which I haven't had a chance to see. I've been meaning to see that. That's one I'm going to want to check out. Only Lovers Left Alive. That is a film about vampires by Jim Jarmusch. Jarhead 2. Which is, of course, the sequel to Jarhead, which I don't know why we needed a sequel to that, but it's direct-to-video. Parks and Recreation Season 6, The Mindy Project Season 2, two of the funniest shows on television. I love both of them. I'm such a girly girl for liking that stuff. And then The Sacrament, which is Ty West's chilling retelling of the Jonestown, a fictionalized version of the Jonestown situation. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's actually decent found footage because it's documentary style, and it's a scary, creepy, just unnerving, true life kind of story. So that's definitely something to check out. No stinker this week because I ran out of time, and there's some decent stuff out there. Next week, I'm going to be talking about As Above, So Below, The November Man, The Congress, and Frank. Not TV's Frank from MST, but Frank. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.